All right, Shabbat Shalom, and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning study coming to you live from St. Francisville, Louisiana. Springtime. It's beautiful weather here. Hopefully it is beautiful where you are, though I must admit that based on the Weather Channel, some of you may not have it quite as glorious as we have it here. But welcome. It is a beautiful day because it's Shabbat. Thanks for joining us. Last week, I made it a point to stress that we are in the first biblical month. Now, whether by the Jewish standard calendar or the sighting of the moon, verified by the stage of Aviv, I mean, no matter how strict you are, no matter what system of the calendar you follow, we're in the first month. So everyone, at least, is on the same calendar month. Now, as far as the day goes, I realize that we've got differences there. Some are saying that we're on X day, and some is another day. And so we can't quite get together yet on the day of the first month. And therefore, people's Passover will be at different times. If you follow the traditional calendar, the Passover Seder will be Friday the 30th. If you're going by the sighting of the moon, I believe it's going to be the 1st of April. But we'll get into that later in the week because I plan to try to write an article and maybe make some sense out of what day it is, right? So that's sort of a joke there about what day it is. What you got, Dave? All right. How is the signal coming? Is the audio working? We'll let the people out in the world test. No one's saying that the audio is not working. We had some technical difficulties earlier, so we're just checking.
I'm assuming it's
working. All right.
See it here, not seeing it here.
All right. Well, evidently it's working. So, okay. But since we are in the first month, we are, according to the Bible, making our way towards the festival or the Chag known as Passover, Pesach in Hebrew. The festival, as we say, of freedom. A festival that begins on the 14th day of the first month. And since this season that we now find ourselves in is associated with a great deliverance, the greatest deliverance known to human history, where Israel, the people of God, are taken out of the control of a nation stronger and mightier than they, where they were serving the Egyptians and brought into servitude with Jehovah. I'm going to be sharing over the next couple of weeks, at least this is the way I feel led at this moment, to be sharing some thoughts in regards to redemption and freedom and Passover and those associated themes over the next couple of weeks leading into the festival season of Passover. Today on the Jewish calendar is a special Sabbath. Once again, this is one of the special Sabbaths. It is known as Shabbat HaGadol. Shabbat HaGadol. Shabbat HaGadol in Hebrew means Sabbath, the big one. This is the big Sabbath, all right? So what's so big about this particular Sabbath? Because I want to lead into my class today by letting you know that this is the special Sabbath known as the big Sabbath. It is the Sabbath on the Jewish calendar that occurs before, immediately preceding, the festival of Passover. So whenever you're approaching Passover, the Sabbath that occurs directly in front of or right before Passover is always known as Shabbat HaGadol. This ties in with the teaching of the prophets because the prophets talk about Passover. So the beautiful thing about this is that any topic that I teach, I can tie in the prophets. In fact, one of the things that I'll be doing today is bringing a very interesting set of prophecies in And I think it's not only relevant to the time in which we are, but it also ties into the season of Passover. Now, various reasons are put forward as to why this particular Sabbath is called Shabbat HaGadol. If you were to Google Shabbat HaGadol or special Sabbaths, you could read all about this, and they'll give various reasons found in rabbinic literature and so forth as to why this particular Sabbath is called the big one. One reason that I even bring it up is because on this particular Sabbath, Shabbat HaGadol, there is a specific prophecy that is read in synagogues around the world. So today, in synagogues all over the world, on this Shabbat, they will be reading from a particular prophecy from a text in Malachi, Malachi. And this particular special Haftarah, as we call it, this prophetic portion, is from Malachi chapter 3, verse 4 through verse 24. Now, that applies to the Hebrew numbering of the text. So if you're in an English Bible, it would be chapter 3, verse 4 through the end of Malachi, which is chapter 4, verse 5. Chapter 4, verse 5. Okay. So, I want to give you a little bit of background, a little bit of setting before I get into my class today. You will see very soon what I'll be talking about. In fact, I've titled this class, The Coming of Elijah. The Coming of Elijah. Now, the setting in this particular passage that I'm referring to in the book of Malachi is eschatological, meaning it deals with end times things. It closes with the mention of a day which is coming. All right, we're going to get into this in depth in just a few minutes. In fact, it says that it is burning like an oven. There's mention of those who will be consumed. The evildoers will be consumed. It even mentions that they'll be consumed to ashes. So we're talking about a time of fire. We're talking about the end times and what is called the great and terrible day, the great day of Jehovah. In the text where it talks about the great day, it's called Gadol. Now, once again, as with every eschatological topic, there are differences of opinion concerning the great day, but we're going to go through some of that in the process of covering the material today. Malachi predicts a coming of a prophet, the coming of a prophet. Now, one of the things that I want to say is that this particular prophet is named, all right? And we're going to look at this a little bit. He is known to us both in history, in legend, myth, and so forth, but this prophet is known to us. We know him. His name is Elijah. I want to begin today's class in the book of Malachi. I want to read a particular passage which happens to be the one which I referred to as the special prophet reading for today. Now, if you're reading in an English Bible, you're going to start where I start. The verses are numbered differently, but we're going to begin in verse 23. I'm going to read a smaller portion first. So we're going to begin in chapter 3, verse 23, which happens to be in the English Bible, Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. Here it goes. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and terrible day of Jehovah comes. And he will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children, the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Today, I'll be talking to you about the coming of Elijah. Again, eschatological, much speculation deals with this particular text, as with many prophetic texts. Most of these differences are long on guessing and short on proof, meaning there's a lot of speculation and not a lot to back it up. Debates exist on many of the details when we talk about the end times. I'll give you an example. In the Talmud in Sanhedrin 98, there is a discussion that's entertained on these folio leaves that deal with the Messiah. In Sanhedrin 98, there are various debates about the Messiah. Who, what, when? An example would be the name of the Messiah. There are questions in Sanhedrin 98 about, do we have evidence of, based on Scripture, the name of the Messiah? In other words, if we were to read the Hebrew Bible and work our way through the Hebrew prophets, would we be able to discern the name of the Messiah? I mean, this is a good question. Many people believe that all throughout the Hebrew Bible, it talks about the Messiah. In fact, many people would tell you that the prophets speak only of the days of the Messiah. If this is the case, it's logically, logically leads us to ask the question, well, if this is the case, do we have evidence in the text of the name of the Messiah? But within Malachi, we do have a detail that seems to be without debate. One detail that we're going to talk about today that is not debated, and that is, who is it that's coming before the great and terrible day? And that name is Elijah. We're even told in this particular text about the mission of this figure. Now, we're talking about an eschatological figure, an end times figure, who is part of the unfolding redemptive scenario, if you will, and we know him. Not, it doesn't require us to guess. It doesn't require us to speculate or even debate. It just basically gives us the name, and then we have this idea of the mission of this Elijah figure. Now, there are two options that are associated with the coming of Elijah, meaning that the outcome of his coming is not yet determined. All right, I want you to really get this because it is significant when we talk about the prophets. Whenever I teach from the prophets, one of the things that is important for people to understand, people look at all the vast literature that make up what we call the prophets. They read all of these scenarios, and they come to the conclusion that everything has to be fulfilled. Listen closely as I read this text once again. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and terrible day of Jehovah comes. All right? Now, is there an option there? No. He says he's going to send Elijah before the day, the great and terrible day of Jehovah comes. So if you're drawing a map of the end times, and on the right, let's just go from left to right, on the right, you write the coming great and terrible day of Jehovah. Now back it up to the left, because right before that, someone is coming. Who is it? It's Elijah. That's chapter 3, verse 23 in the Hebrew, or chapter 4, verse 4, or 4, verse 5 in the English. Now, what are the options? Number one, it says he will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to the fathers. That's option number one. lest I come and smite the land, or the earth as it might be, Eretz, with a curse. So option number one is, I'm going to send Elijah either way. Option number one is there will be a turning of the hearts. Option number two, in other words, if that doesn't happen, if the hearts of the fathers don't turn to the sons and the sons to the fathers, then I'll smite the land or the earth with a curse. You see that? Okay. So what does that tell us? It tells us that, first of all, the first option, though a bit vague, in other words, you might debate, well, what does it mean, turn the hearts of the fathers to the sons, sons of the fathers? What does that mean? That's a question you can put on the shelf. But it means that indicates, at least to me, that there's some restorative movement. There's some restoration, you might say, of families. Is it a specific family? We don't get that information. We just have to assume that there is a restoration element associated with this particular option. Now, the second option is indicative of destruction, a total destruction, I might add. And the only way to avoid the destruction of the land or the earth, whichever way you read that, is by choosing the first option. All right? People might say I'm beating a horse, but I want you to get this. Either there'll be this restoration of hearts to the Father, Father, Son, or there'll be a great destruction. The land will be devoted to a ban of destruction. In Hebrew, it's a cherem. It is a total destruction. All right. So what we get is an either-or scenario. Now, my question to you, and I'll be covering some of these in future classes as we work through various prophetic texts, is this particular thing. I want you to think about this. Most people who study the end times try to sort through on our imaginary line that I just had you draw in your head or on your paper, where the great and terrible day is on the right and the coming of Elijah is right before that. They begin to plug in various prophetic texts. Like, I'll give you an example. When is Gog and Magog? All right. When is the temple going to be rebuilt? When? So you start plugging these pieces in. Because what people have assumed, is that every text has to be plugged in on this line. But what if I told you that there are other either-or scenarios in the prophets? And that's what I'm telling you. Just like this one, there are others. We have to be careful to read very carefully in order to understand that prophecy, and I'm speaking broadly here, is not all determined ahead of time insofar as the outcome. Now you could see how this would be confusing. If you were going to write a book, let's just call it The Late Great Planet Earth. Or think of your own title. That's just the one I thought of. Everybody should get the joke because you should know that Hal Lindsey is one of those who way back in the day wrote a book that basically claimed to lay out what became the evangelical world's understanding of the end times. It's complete with the coming of an Antichrist and he sits in the temple. Well, if that's going to happen, then you have to have a temple rebuilt and there's not a temple. And so you see how you begin to map out the eschatology. What I'm going to do today is zoom in on this final section of Malachi and talk about one aspect of eschatology. One that is in many ways, or should be somewhat at least, notice all my qualifying statements, without debate. Okay? Now, excuse me, when we talk about Malachi, many people think of Malachi as the name of a prophet, Malachi. But and I'll get into this in a little while, whether that is a name or a title, Now, some of you know this, but if you don't, you might want to jot this down. We'll come back to it. Whether Malachi is the name of a prophet or a title, we're dealing with the final prophetic word in the Bible. And this is whether you're a Jew or a Christian, whether you use the Hebrew Tanakh or you use a Christian Old Testament. But what we're going to do is we want to emphasize that Malachi closes out prophecy in the Hebrew Bible. Malachi, the book, closes out the 12. It's called the 12. There is, in the English Bibles, there are 12 what we might call minor prophets. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Nahum, Micah, you know, and so forth. These 12 are called in Hebrew the 12, the 12 minor prophets. I encourage people to really study these because they're often neglected. All right. Now, leading up to the decision point between either the returning of the hearts of the fathers of sons of the fathers, leading up to that, distinctions are clearly made between the good and the bad, the evil and the good. And questions about why this has not been evident in the past. You know, there are people within the text that say, why is it that the bad prosper? How is it that people can be bad and their way prospers anyway? All these questions are leading up to the great and terrible day that's mentioned at the end. Now, here's what I want you to do with me this morning. I want you to go back with me to the third chapter of Malachi. Malachi chapter 3, I want to read verses 1 through 4. I'm going to make some connections here, and you can follow along closely. Malachi chapter 3, verse 1. Behold, I send my messenger to prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. The messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says Jehovah of hosts. But who can endure the day of his coming, and who can stand when he appears? He is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver, and he will purify the sons of Levi, and refine them like gold and silver till they present right offerings to Jehovah. Then the offering of Yehuda, Judah, and Jerusalem will be pleasing to Jehovah as in the days of old and as in former years. All right, a couple of thoughts that strike me when I read chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. Who is my messenger? That's interesting that when you read the English and it says, behold, I will send my messenger. In Hebrew, it says, I will send Malachi. Now, here, Malachi is translated my messenger. In Hebrew, Malach is a messenger. It's sometimes translated as angel, and I think that's inaccurate, but that's the way it's translated sometimes. But whoever is the messenger, we have to question now if the book of Malachi is really about or written, and it's from the point of a messenger named Malachi, or is this book about the messenger of Jehovah who's not named, or maybe he is. See? Right? So we have to go through these details. Now, Malachi in Hebrew means my Malach, my messenger. Malachi, my messenger. Now, if you notice, chapter 3, verse 1, and here's another trick, or not a trick, but a tool to use when interpreting Scripture. You're dealing internally with the text which you're studying. So you have to make associations based upon the words in conjunction with the words and in association with the words. So in Malachi chapter 3, verse 1, it says, "Behold, I'm sending my messenger." Now go back to chapter 4, verse 5. "Behold, I'm sending Elijah." Question becomes, is my messenger of chapter 3, verse 1, the messenger that's mentioned in chapter 4, verse 5, both of which are sent? All right. Now, what I want to do is I want to look through this and talk about the idea or the proposal that the two texts are speaking of the same coming. The first task of Malachi, my messenger. Chapter 3, verse 1. "Behold, I will send my messenger to prepare the way before me." All right. I want to take a pause for 1 second. Again, we're looking for connections within the text. In Hebrew, this says, "Uftina derek lifnai." Prepare the way before me. Now, this particular text, this particular clue, if you will, as to the identity of the messenger, I'm going to take this phrase and I'm going to find it in other places in the Hebrew Bible. You follow me? This is a class on how to study prophetic literature in a way. Because we're talking about the coming of Elijah. We're talking about a messenger that's coming. And here's one of the tasks of the messenger in chapter 3, verse 1. He will prepare the way before me. Now, go with me to Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. Many of you who study the prophets know that Isaiah chapter 40 through 66 is a very important section of the prophets. It's known to the academic world as Deutero-Isaiah, Second Isaiah. And what they mean by that is they propose that the language and the themes are so different than the first 39 chapters of Isaiah that the same author didn't pen it. They believe that this was written later. I don't believe that, and I have evidence to support why I don't believe that for what it's worth. I believe that it is one continuous prophetic unfolding. But in Isaiah chapter 40, I want to pick up in verse 3. Again, I'm reading according to the white spaces. Isaiah 40, beginning in verse 3, says, "A voice is crying." Now, I bring this up all the time. This is not written in, and I'm using English terminology to make this grammatical point. Hebrew's a little bit differently. But it's not indicating that the voice cried in a distant past. It doesn't say that a voice will cry, meaning that it hasn't cried yet. It says, kol kore, a voice is crying, or a voice cries is another way to translate it, meaning that if I shut up, which is hard to do, and we listen, you could hear the voice crying. Notice, a voice cries in the wilderness, prepare the way of Jehovah. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, every mountain and hill be made low. The uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain. And the glory of Jehovah shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of Jehovah has spoken. Now, this particular text, why did I read that? Because it has a connecting point with Malachi chapter 3. A very rare phrase that's used approximately 9 times in the Hebrew Bible, but in the prophets, it only occurs 4 times And each of those four times deals with the end of time. So here in Malachi 3, what we just read earlier, it talks about, "Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me." Notice this text. A voice is crying, "In the wilderness, prepare the way." The connection is the way will be prepared, and I'm associating Isaiah 40 with Malachi chapter 3. Now follow me, and let's go to Isaiah 57. Isaiah 57. In Isaiah 57, I want to pick up. I just want to read verse 14 at first. Isaiah 57, 14, "And it shall be said, build up, build up, prepare the way, remove every obstruction from my people's way." Now, did you hear the command to prepare the way? Again, we're dealing with the phrase in Hebrew, panu derek. Malachi chapter 3 says, "I'm sending my messenger, he'll prepare the way." Isaiah chapter 40, verse 3, says that there is a voice crying, "Prepare the way in the wilderness." Isaiah 57, "Build up, build up, prepare the way." Now, in this particular text, it says something even more specific. In order to prepare the way, obstructions must be cleared from the path of his people. Now, the interesting thing about that is in Isaiah chapter 40, it talks about the preparation of the way. The high place is made low, the low place is made high, the level. See, there is a leveling that takes place. Now, the question becomes, does that have to do with the path whereby the people have to travel? This particular text in Isaiah 57, if you follow the white spaces, it begins in verse 3, chapter 57, verse 3. Now, it begins by condemning false children. Now, stick with me on this. I want to make a connection. Now, I realize that some of this may be hard to follow in this setting, but stick with me and I think it'll make sense. 57, look at this, verse 3. "But you draw near hither, sons of sorcerers, offspring of the adulterer and the harlot." Who in the world is this prophetic text speaking about? Sons of sorcerers, offspring of adulterers and a harlot? Can you believe? Must be talking about Gentiles or something. Not really. This particular text is very hard. Isaiah, hold your hand here. If you go back to Isaiah chapter 1, this is a very key in prophetic literature. In Isaiah chapter 1, it begins in a very strong way. Listen to this. Chapter 1 of Isaiah, verse 2, "Hear, O heavens, give ear, O earth, for Jehovah has spoken. Sons have I reared up and brought up, but they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner, the ass its master's crib, but my people, Israel, does not know. My people do not understand." Now, I know that there are people that go, "Israel's got the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God." Well, they hadn't read their prophets. I'm sorry, but they haven't read their prophets. All right. "Ah," verse 4, "sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, sons who deal corruptly." Who's this talking about? Right? I mean, you can just keep reading over and over and over. Now, a lot of people, later on, he calls them Sodom and Gomorrah, rulers of Sodom and people of Gomorrah. Now, this idea of condemning false children in Isaiah 57, so go back to 57, here are a few things that Isaiah 57 is stating very clearly what he thinks about the people to whom the message goes. He refers to them, his own people, as idolaters and unfaithful, children of transgression, seed of falsehood, sons of sorcerers, seed of the adulterer and the harlot. And then in verse 13 and 14, listen. When you cry out, let your collection of idols deliver you. The wind will carry them off. A breath will take them away. But he who takes refuge in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain. And it will be said, build up, build up. Prepare the way. Remove every obstruction from my people's way. You understand that Isaiah is condemning the falsehood that has been spread among his people. He says that those who hearken to the voice, what voice? Isaiah chapter 40. And follow in the right path, the path which has been cleared, they'll be okay. Now finally, in a text that begins in chapter 61, verse 10, and runs all the way through 62, verse 9 of Isaiah, from 61:10 to 62:9, we read of a coming redemption. All right? So as we work through this particular chapter, this particular portion of text, it deals with a coming redemption. Now, I want you to look with me at chapter 62, verse 10. Now, I'm going to read you the section that's set off by white spaces. We're talking about the time of redemption. Verse 10, go through the gates. Prepare the way. Here's our panu derek. Prepare the way for the people. Build up the highway. Clear it of stones. Lift up an ensign over the peoples. Behold, Jehovah is proclaimed to the end of the earth. Say to the daughter of Zion, behold, your salvation comes. Behold, his reward is with him and his recompense before him. And they shall be called the holy people, the redeemed of Jehovah, and you shall be called sought out, a city not forsaken. Now, this particular text deals with the basically the way that it all comes together in dealing with preparing the way. The messenger is associated. The children of falsehood are being restored in a way. Now, I want to go back to this idea in Malachi. Go with me to Malachi chapter 3. Malachi chapter 3. Now, hopefully you're writing down these passages because I'm covering a lot of ground, but I want you to see the connections here. Okay. Malachi chapter 3, verse 2. Who can endure the day of his coming, and who can stand when he appears? He is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver, and he will purify the sons of Levi and refine them like gold and silver till they present a right offering to Jehovah. Now, this particular book, the book of Malachi, if you read it from the beginning, it is a very harsh word to the people who are supposed to be instructing God's people. It is a warning. It is a very strong word that basically says those who are supposed to be teaching have failed to do so. And I'm not going to read the entire thing, but if you begin in chapter 2, Now, you can start in chapter 1, but if you begin in chapter 2, verse 1, just to give you a taste of it, "And now, O priest," is he talking to, "this command is for you. If you will not listen, if you will not lay it to heart to give glory to my name, says Jehovah of hosts, then I will send the curse upon you, and I will curse your blessings. Indeed, I've already cursed them. Because you did not lay it to heart, behold, I will rebuke your offspring and spread dung upon your faces, the dung of your offerings. And I will put you out of my presence. And you'll know that I've sent this command to you, that my covenant with Levi may hold, says the Lord of hosts." And then he goes into talking about what that covenant was supposed to be versus what they did with it. All right. But in Malachi chapter 3, verses 2 and 3, this coming messenger, his coming is associated with fire. This is a key point. It's almost an indicator as to identity. His coming is associated with fire. Now look at chapter 4, verse 1, which in Hebrew would be chapter 3, verse 19. All right? In chapter 4, verse 1, "For behold, the day comes, burning like an oven, when all the arrogant and all evildoers will be stubble. The day that comes shall burn them up, says Jehovah of hosts, so that it will leave them neither root nor branch." All right, now listen to this. "But," now this is the distinction that comes at the end of days, "but for you who fear my name, the sun," S-U-N, "of righteousness shall rise with healing in its wings. You shall go forth leaping like calves from the stall." In verse 3, "You shall tread down the wicked, for they will be ashes under the soles of your feet on the day when I act, says the Lord of hosts." There is a consumption of the wicked in fire. Now, that's a true statement. That's from the Hebrew Bible. It's not the only place it mentions this, but there is a fire associated in the end of days, and some like to ignore this or put it in a minimal emphasis. Now, let me ask you this. Have you ever read the prophet Isaiah? You know how Isaiah, interesting that Malachi ends with this idea of a fiery retribution on the wicked. Look at Isaiah 66, verse 24. This is the last thing mentioned in the prophet Isaiah. "And they shall go forth and look on the dead bodies of the men that have rebelled against me, for their worm shall not die, their fire shall not be quenched, and they shall be an abhorrence to all flesh." Now, thus ends the words of Isaiah on a happy note. You see that? Now, a lot of people want to take that part out, but in the eschatos, in the end of days, there is an end to the wicked. And this particular passage makes it pretty clear that it's a fiery end, which is exactly what Malachi is saying. Now, I want you to go with me back again to Malachi, and this time we're going to read the last few verses of Malachi again as they're indicated by the white space. So we're going to start with verse 4, Malachi 4:4, or in the Hebrew Bible, in the Tanakh, it's chapter 3, verse 22. Now, Malachi 4:4 or 3:22 in Hebrew. White space. "Remember the Torah of my servant Moses, the statutes and ordinances that I commanded him at Horeb for all Israel. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and terrible day of Jehovah comes. And he will turn the hearts of fathers to the children, and the hearts of children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the land with a harem, a ban for total destruction. You see the either or, how it's expanded a little bit? Remember the Torah of Moses, my servant, that I commanded all Israel at Horeb, statutes and judgments. And then he says, I'm sending Elijah. Elijah is going to turn the hearts of the fathers to the sons of the fathers, lest I smite the land with a curse. Elijah is coming. What will be the decision when he comes? Will the hearts of the sons be restored to the hearts of the fathers and the hearts of the fathers to the sons, or will the land be smitten with a curse? That's the options. And we have to start sorting this out when we study the end of days. What we do know is that Elijah is coming. This figure is named. Now I want to read to you, because I want to talk about Elijah a little bit more specifically. I'm going to read to you from an apocryphal book. You know about the Apocrypha. In the apocryphal book, known as The Wisdom of Ben Sirach, now some of you are saying, I don't even have that, but you can look it up online. But this is an interesting passage. It comes from chapter 48 of Sirach. It's also known as Ecclesiasticus. Ecclesiasticus. Sirach, S-I-R-A-C-H. And I have extra copies here at the building. And the reason I want to read this, this particular document was written, according to most scholars, about the time of 180 BCE, almost 200 years before the Common Era. Fragments of the Hebrew wisdom of Sirach were discovered at Qumran. So this was known. This literature was known. Now, I want to read it because I want to read something about Elijah from it. It says, then the prophet Elijah arose like a fire, and his word burned like a torch. He brought a famine upon them, and by his zeal he made them few in number. By the word of the Lord he shut up the heavens, and also three times brought down fire. How glorious you were, O Elijah, in your wondrous deeds, and who has the right to boast what you have? You who raised a corpse from death, and from Hades by the word of the Most High, who brought kings down to destruction and famous men from their beds, who heard rebuke at Sinai and judgments of vengeance at Horeb, who anointed kings to inflict retribution and prophets to succeed you, you who were taken up by a whirlwind of fire in a chariot with horses of fire, you who are ready at the appointed time, it is written, to calm the wrath of God before it breaks out in fury, to turn the heart of the father to the son, and to restore the tribes of Jacob. Blessed are those who saw you, and those who've been adorned in love, for we shall surely live. It was Elijah who was covered by the whirlwind, and Elisha was filled with his spirit. Did you notice in Ecclesiasticus, in Sirach, this ancient document, how you can say, well, that's not canonical, that's not approved material? I study all sorts of ancient literature. I love to read the Dead Sea Scrolls. I want to get more information as to the way the ancient people understood these stories. Now, was there anything in this that I just read that doesn't seem to jive with the story of Elijah? I'd say no. This particular summary in Sirach makes it very clear. Did you notice the constant reference to fire? Fire over and over and over. In verses 1 through 3, arose like fire, burned like a torch, his word did, over and over. Now, if we want to study the life of Elijah, it doesn't take long. Yesterday, I read through every account of the life of Elijah and in all ancient literature that I could find. Anything that I could find on Elijah, I spent much of the day yesterday reading through. Now, a lot of this material on the life and times of Elijah comes from the book of Kings, from 1 Kings and 2 Kings. Here are those passages. I'm not going to read them. I'm going to give them to you so you can study them on your own. 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 1, through chapter 18, verse 46. 1 Kings 19, verse 1 through 21. 1 Kings 21, 1 through 21, 1 through 29, and 2 Kings chapter 1 and 2. Now, those are the main texts which deal with the, for lack of a better word, the ministry of Elijah the prophet in its historical setting. You read those, you get that, and it's very informative. Now, just a quick review of the things that took place in the time of Elijah. Now, I want to make one more point about my use of Sirach, because a lot of people will say, well, you know, the Catholics have that in their Bible, and so therefore people want to say, I can't read it. Guess what else is in that Catholic collection? Maccabees, right? So if you read 1st and 2nd Maccabees and you want to study the time of Hanukkah, you're going to go to the Talmud and read a few myths and legends, or you're going to go to the book of Maccabees. It's the only ancient source, right? That's how we know about it. So there are things within these documents that are very important for us. Again, I like studying all this ancient literature. My Bible is the Hebrew Bible, but I have other sources that shed light on that I think are very important. Okay, now, in 1 Kings chapter 17, there is a drought that is brought on by the word of Elijah. Elijah says, there will not be rain again until I say. And guess what happened? It didn't rain. A drought followed. Now, we don't get in the story that God said, Elijah, make this pronouncement and I'll back you up. Elijah said, let there not be rain, and there was not rain. All right? So Elijah is a rain stopper. And guess what? It was not until he said, bring the rain, that it happened again. So he's a rain maker. Elijah, according to the traditions in the Hebrew Bible, has some power, right? This is a pretty strong word. All right. He is, during this drought, he is miraculously fed by ravens who bring him food when he's at the brook Kerit. Here he is in hiding, and birds are feeding him, right? God's helping his man out. Yep. He goes in the next story in chapter 17, beginning in verse 7, to the widow of Zarephath. This isn't even an Israelite. Interesting that God would send him to someone who's not even an Israelite in his time. All right. Now he goes there. She also takes care of him. But if you remember in the story, when he first comes up to her, this woman's picking up sticks. And he sees her and he said, hey, woman, I'd like a little drink of water. and maybe you can make me some bread. I'm paraphrasing. This is in 1 Kings 17, verse 7 through 16. And she said, look, I'm just picking up some sticks. I'm going to go make a fire. I'm cooking the last meal for my son and I, and we're going to die. He said, no, let's do it this way. Get me a drink. Go make me a meal first, just like a preacher, right? Go make me a meal first, and God will bless you. In fact, a lot of preachers use this to teach their prosperity message. Help the preacher first. But I'm not preaching that. But here's the idea. It says, go and make that. Bring it to me, and a miracle's going to happen. And it did. There were two miracles, in fact. Her jug of oil miraculously never runs out. Her jar of flour miraculously never runs out. And that shows that God was backing up the word of his prophet. Now, in 1 Kings 17, beginning in verse 17, he raises the boy from the dead. The widow woman, her son died. And she's mad at him. She doesn't express faith. You ever see these televangelists that say if you come up with a miracle and it doesn't, you're not healed, it's because you didn't have faith. She basically comes at him and says, why did you lie to me? She's mad at him. You caused my son to die. And he didn't say, we need to work on your faith a little bit. He just says, give me the boy. Takes the boy upstairs and lays on top of him, mouth to mouth, hand to hand, feet to feet, and breathes on him, and the boy comes back to life. He brings the boy back down. So he is a rain stopper, a rain maker, a miracle performer, the raiser of the dead. This is Elijah I'm talking about. This is some full gospel stuff going on here. This is good news. Now, the next story that we read about Elijah is that he has an encounter with Ahab. Now, Ahab is the worst of the worst. And we'll cover a couple of those passages in a moment. But he has a clash with Ahab. And basically, the prophets of Baal. Now, in the biblical times, one of the most treacherous departures of the faith involved Baal, to pray and worship the Baalim. Baal means Lord, basically. So there were all these lords that people were praying and worshiping that weren't Jehovah. And that was the case in the time of Elijah. So Elijah challenges the prophets of Baal. He tells Ahab, look, you get all those prophets and you bring them and meet me at Mount Carmel. And we're going to have a showdown. And you remember the story. 1 Kings chapter 18, there is a great showdown between the prophets of Baal and Elijah. Now, some of the bad prophets got away. We're not going to talk about that, but all those for the Asherah, but be that as it may, that might be in another class. Go to 1 Kings 18, though. 1 Kings 18, this is the story about this confrontation on Mount Carmel. And Elijah's talking trash, too, as we say in our vernacular. He says, look, you're going to cut up your sacrifice, and I'm going to cut up mine, and you're going to do this. And so then he says, you go first. And these prophets call out to their God from morning all day, and they're cutting themselves. And he said, maybe y'all aren't talking loud enough. Maybe your God's going to the bathroom. Maybe he's asleep. Maybe whatever. And, you know, he's really, really belittling them and their false worship. And then he calls down fire from heaven. Again, notice Elijah's association with fire from heaven. Interesting. Now, I want you to look at chapter 18, 1 Kings 18, verse 37. Because, first of all, let me set the context. His job is to turn the hearts of the people away from their idols. Ah, maybe we'll get a clue now to the meaning in Malachi. Listen to this, verse 37. Answer me, O Jehovah. Answer me, that this people may know that thou, O Jehovah, art God, and that you have turned their hearts back. Now, this is the only reference in the ancient literature associated with Elijah that deals with the turning of hearts. All right? Reference is 1 Kings 18, verse 37. Now, the next story, and I'm just going through these sort of topographically and quickly. The next story is in 1 Kings 19, verses 1 through 18. When Jezebel, the wicked queen, the wife of Ahab, when she hears that Elijah has killed all these prophets, she puts out word. Come morning light, you're going to be just like they are. In other words, you're going to be dead. Now, Elijah flees. God didn't tell him to flee, but Elijah runs. He's scared. He runs off, and he goes, and that's what the story of 1 Kings 19 covers. He meets Jehovah at Horeb. Now, read that on your own time, but notice the connection, because what he says is he's asked by the messenger. But then the next verse, it seems to be, is it the messenger? Is it Jehovah? Who is it he's talking to? But he's asked, what are you doing here, Elijah? Remember that? I'll give you an example of his answer. He says, verse 10 of 1 Kings 19, I have been very jealous for Jehovah, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant. See, notice how he switches to the third person. Your covenant. I was jealous for Jehovah, right? For the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, slain your prophets with the sword, and I only am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Then he gets into this conversation, and a little while later, he's asked again, what are you doing here, Elijah? And he said, I've been very jealous for the... He answers it the same way. The point is that at the end of this story, he's basically told to go and anoint your own replacement. You're going to anoint another king. You're going to also anoint your replacement. So some have proposed that this indicates a firing of Elijah. And some might say, well, I'm not sure I buy into that. Well, don't think for one minute that God is light on those that he calls for great task. Moses isn't even allowed into the promised land, right? So let's not be too quick to say God wouldn't fire a prophet. He certainly anoints his replacement. Now, we're going to go into something that makes it maybe another possibility here in a few minutes. Now, after this story, we're introduced to a prophet by the name of Elisha. All right. Now, that comes in chapter 19, beginning in verse 19. So let's pick that up. 1 Kings 19:19 says, so he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him. And he was with the 12th. Elijah passed by him and cast his mantle upon him. And he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, let me kiss my father and my mother, and then I'll follow you. And he said to him, go back again, for what have I done to you? And he returned from following him and took the yoke of oxen and slew them, boiled their flesh with the yokes of the oxen, and gave it to the people, and they ate. And then he arose and went after Elijah and ministered to him. So now you've got Elijah, and following him is Elisha. Now, if you read these stories, that's two you don't want to tangle with. That's a powerful team right there. Now, the next story, and I'm just going to hit this one also very high level, is the story of a vineyard that belonged to Naboth. And Naboth had a vineyard, and King Ahab wanted it because it adjoined his palace. He sent word to Naboth, and he said, I'd like to have that property. And I'll gladly give you another piece of property for it. Now, as wicked as Ahab is, at this point, he hasn't violated any Torah principle. He's offered the purchase of this land. Now, I'm not going to get into that because some are probably saying, I don't know, you're not supposed to give the land away. But there is good Torah legislation that covers this. And so far, so good. But Naboth says, no, you can't have my property. So he goes back and cries, turns his back, and he's all in the fetal position in his bed, and his wife sees him crying. She said, what's wrong, dear? And he said, well, I wanted this property, but I can't have it. And she said, be a man, be a king. And she sends a letter out and basically orders the execution of Naboth, and then he takes the property. Now, when that happens, all hell breaks loose. All right? And this is really one of the downfalls of King Ahab. Let me show you how bad he is, though. Two verses. Go to 1 Kings 16 and verse 33. 1 Kings 16, 33. He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. And Ahab made an Asherah. Ahab did more to provoke Jehovah, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. Now, that's saying something. All right? Now, look, one other verse. Look at chapter 21 of 1 Kings. 1 Kings 21, verse 25. There was none who sold himself to do what was evil in the sight of Jehovah, like Ahab, whom Jezebel, his wife, incited. So she gets a little credit for his being so bad, but it says none. I mean, this is the baddest of the bad, the worst of the worst. Now, in 2 Kings chapter 1, now we're getting towards the end of the career, if you will, of Elijah in the history of ancient Israel. In 2 Kings chapter 1, he sends word to Ahaziah, the king. And he basically gets into somewhat of a back and forth with the king. And so they send, the king sends for men to get Elijah. And Elijah tells them, they said, look, you man of God, you come down here and we're going to take you in, basically. And he says, if I'm a man of God, let fire from heaven come down and consume all of y'all. And that's what happens. So they send another man with 50 men with him, this is the second time, to Elijah, and they say, man of God, come down. He said, if I'm a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume all y'all. And again, it happens. Next one comes. He's learned a lesson. And he approaches things a little bit differently. And he says, listen to this. Oh, man of God, I pray, let my life and the life of these 50 servants of yours be precious in your sight. Lo, fire came down from heaven and consumed the two former captains of 50 men with their 50s. But now let my life be precious in your sight. Then the angel of Jehovah said to Elijah, go down with him. Don't be afraid of him. See, that's a good lesson for us. It's all in your manner of approach. You got to be humble.
Don't be the first one.
Yeah, don't be the first one. And don't be the second, if you can help it. And learn from the mistakes of others is probably a pretty important lesson there. Now, it's interesting that when they refer to him as the man of God, Ish Elohim, he turns that. He uses a wordplay in Hebrew. He says, if I'm Ish Elohim, then let Ish Elohim fire from heaven. You think I'm a man of God? Send fire from heaven. So Ish Elohim, when you talk about Elijah, is associated with the fire of God. Now that's one of the points that I wanted to get to. According to Ecclesiasticus, according to Sirach, it said that three times there is an association of fire being called down from heaven by Elijah. Once in the story of the prophets of Baal, he calls down fire from heaven, and twice when these people come to arrest him. So he becomes associated with calling down fire from heaven. Now look at 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 1. Now when Jehovah was about to take Elijah up to heaven by whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. It's a known point in the story of 2 Kings that God is going to take Elijah. Now, everyone seems to know this. The reader is brought in on this because what happens is everyone goes up to Elijah in the story, Elisha, and says, hey, we heard that your master is going to be taken from you today. And he says, I know it. Be quiet. He doesn't want to face it. It's like he doesn't want his teacher to go, but they know that Elijah is going to be taken away. This is interesting. Now, look at chapter 2 of 2 Kings, beginning in verse 9. When they had crossed, talking about the River Jordan, Elijah said to Elisha, ask what I shall do for you before I am taken from you. And Elisha said, I pray you, let me inherit a double share of your spirit. And he said, you've asked a hard thing. Yet, if you see me as I am being taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if you don't see me, it shall not be so. And as they still went on and talked, behold, a chariot of fire and horses of fire separated the two of them, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it, and he cried, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horses. And he saw him no more. And he took hold of his own clothes and rent them in two pieces. And he took up the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. He took the mantle of Elijah. Now, remember when Elijah first tells Elisha to follow him, he throws his mantle over him. Now that mantle belongs to Elisha. Now this is an interesting piece of clothing. He took the mantle, verse 14, of Elijah that had fallen from him, and he struck the water, saying, where is Jehovah, the God of Elijah? And when he had struck the water was parted to the one side and to the other, and Elisha went over, just like Moses. Now, that's not the first time that this happened, because look at back in chapter 2, verse 8. Excuse me. Chapter 2, verse 8. Elijah took his mantle, rolled it up, and struck the water, and the water was parted to the one side and to the other, till the two of them could go over on dry ground. Elijah is in some ways associated in very interesting narrative stories with the prophet Moses. Now remember, Moses will raise a prophet like Moses. This is an interesting connection here. Elijah strikes the water and the water parts and so forth. Now, when Elisha goes forward with the mantle, he says, he whacks the water and says, where's the God of Elijah? And when he does, the water parts. Interestingly enough, a lot of people, mystics primarily, will call on the name of Elijah just like Elisha did, and they think they have a biblical precedent because Elisha did it, right? So some of these interesting beliefs are formulated by stories that we read in the Bible. Now, all right, our story ends in verse 15 about Elijah. Now, when the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho saw him, meaning Elisha, over against them, they said, "The spirit of Elijah rest on Elisha." The spirit of Elijah is on Elisha. Now, that's an interesting statement. For the next several chapters in 2 Kings, we meet with statements in various stories where it basically says, and this took place as was spoken by the prophet Elijah. His words continue to be fulfilled because his words are spirit and they are life. Elijah is no longer working on the ground, you might say. But those words that he spoke were still being fulfilled. And then, silence. Until Malachi. Last thing we see in the text is Eliyahu Hanavi going to heaven in a chariot of fire with horses of fire. In a whirlwind, and then silence. Until Malachi, who says he's coming again. I just had a thought. What's that song? Eli's coming. Different Eli, but Elijah's coming. This will be, according to Malachi, a second coming of Elijah. Now, again, a lot of people talk about the Messiah and they speculate as to who he is or who it's when he's coming or what's his name. And we don't know a lot of that. But what we do know, according to Malachi, is that Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah, is coming again. There ought to be churches built about the second coming of Elijah, right? There ought to be synagogues dedicated to the return of Elijah because this is a known eschatological event with a named coming figure. Now the question is, he's coming again, but how? In what form? Will he be the literal? Will it be literally the Elijah who left? You know, "You men of the Jordan River, why stand ye gazing into heaven? This same Elijah which was taken from you." Will, you know, I could almost imagine a conversation like that. Or will it be someone who is endowed with the spirit of Elijah? By the way, one other reason they call this the Big Sabbath is because rabbis, though I'm not a rabbi, but rabbis often give a big lesson on that day. So this might go a little bit longer, so stay with me. So will it be literally Eliyahu, Elijah, or will it be someone who goes forth, as it says here in verse 15 of 2 Kings 2, one upon whom the spirit of Elijah rests? It's a good question. Now, from here, legend takes over. Mystics and myth makers love a good mystery. I mean, it's not very common in ancient literature, at least in the Hebrew Bible, that one is snatched away in a whirlwind, chariot of fire with horses of fire. In fact, it only happens once here. Now, some might talk about Enoch, which they do, because in Enoch, there's a strange ending to him. Genesis 5 says, "And this person had sons and daughters, and they died. This person that lived this many years and had sons and daughters, and they died." It's the same pattern. And you get down to chapter 5, verse 24, and it says, "And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him." So whenever somebody reads that, they go, "Whoa, whoa, 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 wait a minute. But God took him? What do you mean God took him?" And they begin to build up myths and, you know, stories. And So we've got Enoch, who disappeared kind of strangely. Lots of stories about him. We have Elijah, who's taken away in a whirlwind of fire, chariots of fire, horses of fire. It's perfect to come up with stories about him. Moses is a little mysterious in his departure, too. So Elijah becomes one of the end times figures in any good biblical eschatological study. If you're going to talk about the end times and the way this, the redemptive scenario unfolds, you got to plug in Elijah. And that's what people have done. And whether or not you accept it, this has been the case in ancient literature. According to rabbinic literature, there are all sorts of stories. There is more written about the figure of Elijah in rabbinic literature than any other biblical character, because it's such a cool story. Now, I talked to you, I talked about a little bit about rabbinic literature. I've included something from the Apocrypha, from the book of Sirach. I'm talking today about Elijah, and so I want to kind of wrap things up with this idea that became part of Christian tradition associated with Elijah. Now, a lot of my listeners aren't Christians. They might have been former Christians. They may not have ever been Christians. But it is an important piece in understanding the way the ancients viewed the coming of Elijah, and I want to include it, because you cannot ignore the fact that it's quite brilliant the way that these texts are at least understood. So I wanted to hit a couple of passages because I think it's interesting. Number one, I'm going to read from the book of John, chapter 1. Stick with me on this. You might be surprised. In chapter 1 of John, it says in verse 19, "And this is the testimony of John when the Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, 'Who are you?'" So John the Baptist is out doing his thing. The priests and Levites send a delegation to ask him, "Who are you?" Now notice this. He confessed, he did not deny, but confessed, "I am not the Messiah." And they ask him, "What then? Are you Elijah?" He said, "I am not." "Are you the prophet?" And he answered, "No." And they said to him, "Who are you then? Let us have an answer for those who sent us. What do you say about yourself?" Now, I want to stop there for a minute. Did you get that? No, but I mean, I want you to get the complexity. They didn't just go, "Oh, are you the Messiah? Because we're waiting on a Messiah." See, everybody wants to take this complexity and brush it off the table. What I want to do as I begin to really deeply delve into the prophetic text with you is say, it ain't that easy. We're not just looking for the Messiah. In fact, the Messiah, HaMashiach, is never, ever mentioned one single time in all of the prophecies about eschatological figures. Not one time. Some of you might say, what about Isaiah 61? We'll get to that. But Elijah is. Nowhere does it ever say the Messiah. People can talk about the suffering servant. They can talk about the Son of Man coming on the clouds. They can talk about the prince. They can talk about... Never once is he called the Messiah. In fact, HaMashiach is only used four times, and it's always in the book of Leviticus, and it's about a priest, and it's not about an eschatological figure. All right, I'm back on earth now. What they ask him is, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the prophet? Are you Elijah?" So notice that their expectation for eschatological figures is a little bit broader than most people's today. They're looking for a complex system of figures. Now, verse 23, He says, no, 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 I'm not that, I'm not that, I'm not that. And they go, well, who are you then? He goes, ah, glad you asked. Verse 23, I love this. He said, I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness, make straight the way of the Lord, as the prophet Isaiah said. Ah, you're the voice. You're not the prophet. You're not the Messiah. You're not Elijah. You're the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way. Now, why did I spend all that time today going through the text that say, prepare the way? Because I wanted you to have them in your notes, and I want you to begin to think that there is a figure whose task it is to prepare the way. Now, this is only going to get more complex in coming weeks and months and years because we're going to have to follow the text. Now, notice, again, I am the one, the voice of one crying in the wilderness. Now, here we go. What I want you to do is go to chapter 3 of Matthew. Matthew chapter 3. And verses 1 through 3. In those days, excuse me, came John the Baptist preaching in the wilderness of Judea, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. For this is he who was spoken of by the prophet Isaiah when he said, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight. And then, if you continue to read, you would see that he is dressed similar to the way that we would expect if he were somehow associated with Elijah. But all this is going to make sense in a moment. Now, look at Mark. Mark chapter 1. Again, stick with me. All these ancient texts tell us something about the way the people are interpreting these things. I could care less if you agree or disagree with is he or is he not Elijah or whatever. That's not my point. The point is I'm showing you complexity from the Hebrew Bible and in the way that the ancients understood the text. Mark chapter 1, verse 2. As it is written in Isaiah the prophet. Now, by the way, that's a mistake. You can put a soft line on Isaiah and write Malachi out to the side. A little bit of a misquote, but who's catching? All right. Behold, I send my messenger before thy face, who will prepare thy way, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight. Now, what Mark, the writer of Mark, whoever that is, what Mark is doing here is he is weaving together a medley of text, which includes Malachi and Isaiah, because he's doing what I did earlier. He's saying, prepare the way. That's here. I'll pull that. Thank you very much from Malachi 3. Oh, by the way, I'm going to pull it from Isaiah chapter 40. It's brilliant. How do I know it's brilliant of Mark to do? Because I did it too. I'm joking. But it is brilliant. You're trying to connect the dots. You're pulling together ancient prophetic text. Mark does it, and it's the way that you're supposed to look at these prophecies. Now, again, both Matthew and Mark are going to give examples of his teaching. Now, quickly, I've got a couple more because I'm leading up to something, believe it or not. Matthew chapter 16. Now, this is a particular text where Jesus, Yeshua, asks a question. He says, who do men say that I am? Right? We're back to that. Who are you? Because it's a big identity point. Are you this? Are you that? Are you that? Now, notice what they say. Verse 14. And they said, he just said, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? Some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. And others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. You see, they don't know who he is. I mean, they're asking the question. He's somebody. You're either, well, some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, some say one of the prophets. Jeremiah, maybe. Now, I think it's interesting that they're interpreting these things like this. Now, in Mark chapter 6, just put this in your note, Mark chapter 6, verse 14, he is also, someone else says that he's Elijah. I think in that particular setting, Herod is trying to figure out who he is. Now, in chapter 17 of Matthew, it is a vision of the end. He says, some of you will not taste death until you see this, and he shows them a vision. Now, in the vision, you have who? Jesus is with Moses and Elijah. All right, now that's interesting that Moses and Elijah are there. That, those two are very much connected in our ancient sources. Interesting connection, by the way. Now, got a couple more passages. If you'll go with me, I know I have friends who don't have the New Testament Christian writings, but if you have it, go to Mark 9. Mark 9. In verse 11. Now, this is after the vision of the end of days, where the Elijah and Moses are there. And here's what they said, verse 11, Mark 9. And they ask him, why do the scribes say that Elijah must first come? Now, remember in my diagram I had you draw the linear, here's a great day coming. And back it up one, you got to have Elijah coming. So they're saying, hold up. You're showing me a vision of the end. Where's Elijah in here? That's a good question. I mean, it's logical, it's linear, it is, how do we fit this in here? So they, let's see. And verse 12, he said to them, Elijah does come first to restore all things. And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they pleased, as it is written of him. Now, by the way, we're going to explore some of these things in another class, but I want you to think about this. They said, a good question, why does it say Elijah has to come? Where's Elijah? And he said he did come. By the way, the Son of Man has to suffer and so forth. And he said he did come, and they did to him whatever it was they wanted to do as it was written. So he's already got an idea that somewhere in the prophets it predicts that Elijah too will suffer.
Is it there?
Huh?
Is it there?
I believe it is, and I think I can show it in another class. You got to hold me to that. We ain't getting into it today. But think about it. Where could it be written of him? Now, we know that he makes an association of a certain figure in his own time, Jesus with a figure in his own time, of who this Elijah figure is. So go with me to Luke. Yeah, but in Luke 1, yeah, I've carefully selected these. I'm not reading all of them. In Luke 1, verse 13, the messenger said to him, do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer is heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son. You'll call his name John, and you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great before the Lord. He will not drink wine or strong drink. He'll be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb. He will turn many of the sons of Israel to the Lord their God. Notice the turning of sons. Interesting. And he will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready for the Lord a people prepared. Now, you can tick those off. Again, you might say, I don't believe that any of this is true, that a later scribe made all this up. Fine. My point is that the writer of this text is associating the checklist for who this Elijah figure is. And that's what they're trying to do, is make this point. So on this special Sabbath, called the big one. We consider the coming day of Jehovah the great and awesome, a day preceded by the coming of Elijah. Now, I covered a lot of material about Elijah today. I told you that Elijah could stop and start the rain. Elijah could raise the dead. Elijah could call fire down from heaven and convince the people, causing their hearts to turn back to Jehovah, causing them to know that Jehovah, Hu Ha Elohim, Jehovah He is God. All of those things, all of those miracles, everything that we talked about, those are great miracles. Not a single one is associated with the end of days prophecy in Malachi. Think about that. Because the miracle that has to happen, according to Malachi, is greater than starting and stopping the rain. It's greater than raising the dead. It's greater than calling fire down from heaven. It's a task that God has to use the greatest prophet to do, and that's to restore the hearts of the fathers to the children and children to the fathers. Or there's coming a destruction. And when you think about that, there is a day coming, consuming like fire. The bad will be burned up and all that. But right before that, Elijah is going to come. Now, will he do these other things as well? I don't know. But I do know that this will be the greatest task that's ever been before him. And I think it's interesting that that's what he's tasked with. Question becomes, how will the people of that day respond? When Elijah does come back, whether it's the prophet himself or one who is clothed in the spirit and power of Elijah, will they respond to the message of restoration? Because the only other option is that the earth will be smitten. And that becomes a great question. The only way to avoid the destruction, the ban of destruction, is by returning the heart. As we get ready for Passover season, people will be hosting in their homes, in their church or their synagogue, a Passover Seder, and they'll leave a chair for Elijah. Do you really want him sitting at your table? Is he really welcome? You see, people love the myth and the mysticism, and they love the storytelling and the pageantry of religion. But are we really ready for a restoration? Years ago, I read a book called There Is No Messiah, and You're It. And in that book, a rabbi in an inner city who wrote the book describes a story where he had an interfaith Seder. And a girl came into the Seder and she looked around and this beautiful chair was all made up and no one was sitting in it. And she asked the rabbi, she said, "Whose chair is that?" He said, it's for Elijah. She said, "Elijah?" And he said, "Yeah, it's part of what we do in the Passover because Elijah is supposed to come back." And she said, "Well, what's he going to do?" He said, "Oh, man, he's going to restore everything." You know, and she's a young girl, so he's trying to talk on her level. And he said, When Elijah comes back, the world is going to be fixed, and you know, people aren't going to discriminate against one another. And he goes through a list of various things. And all of a sudden, she looked at him and she said, "Why do we have to wait for Elijah to do that?" And he said, "You know, the Passover Seder is designed with questions built in. But that's not one of the questions built in." He said it was the most powerful question he's ever had anybody ask him at a Passover Seder. So I now ask you, why are we waiting on Elijah? Now, I'm saying it says that Elijah's coming. But do we really need to wait on that day to begin the restoration? And I say we can begin now. When he comes, it's going to be do or die. I say we start it today. So think about these things as we begin to prepare for the season of freedom, the season of redemption, the season of salvation, the festival of Passover. Thank you for listening and for putting up with my use of all these texts. I want you to think about all of them, and I'm glad that I used every one of them. And if you stick around, we'll come back to you in a little while with a dialogue session. Shabbat Shalom.